My name's Tony K. Lynn. I was born in Madison, Wisconsin, November 8th, 1986. I served in Operation Enduring Freedom in the conflict we had in Afghanistan. I was a sergeant when I transitioned out of the Marine Corps. This is University of Montana in Missoula, Montana.
The interviewer is Keith McLaughlin. The interview is being conducted for the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress.
So where were you born?
I was born in Madison, Wisconsin, in November 8th, 1986.
What did your parents do for an occupation?
My parents owned a restaurant in Marshfield, Wisconsin, and then they later moved to Madison, Wisconsin. And currently, I'm not sure what they do for occupation. But.
Do you have any brothers or sisters?
I have two older sisters, and the one just older than me is Susie, and the oldest one is Amy. And Susie lives in New York, while Amy lives in Arlington, Virginia.
Do you have any other family members that have served in the military?
No, I am the first in my family to serve in the military.
Did you always want to serve in the military?
Not at first, but during high school I took an interest in the military, and I was interested in serving my country, and I wasn't ready to go to college yet. I was tired of school and wanted some adventure in my life, and thought the best way would be to fight for America.
So why did you choose the Marines?
The Marine Corps seemed like a branch that you would only join the Marine Corps if you wanted to see action. The other branches people joined for benefits, whereas the Marine Corps didn't get as many benefits in the Marine Corps. You only joined the Marine Corps for action.
Jumping back a little bit, what was your childhood like?
I had a normal childhood. I had pretty decent grades in school, and if I wouldn't have gone to the military, I would have just gone to college like any normal student would. I didn't really play too many sports, and just a pretty plain and boring childhood.
So, going back to the time you enlisted, what was it like on the day that you enlisted? Do you have any?
Well, my mom would not sign my the papers before I was 18, so I had to wait till I was 18 to sign them myself, and then I ended up just taking off with a recruiter to the MEP station, and I called my mom and told her to call me in sick for school because I'm signing the papers to join the Marine Corps, and kind of just broke away and joined myself.
What did your parents have to say at that
point? They didn't approve at all. They wanted me to go to college, and they didn't want me to join the military.
How about your sisters?
They were in the same boat. Both my sisters went to University of Madison, or University of Wisconsin, Madison, and both of them ended up going to graduate school and being very academic. And then I didn't feel that was right for me at the time, so I ran off and joined the Marine Corps by myself.
But did that support come later?
No, it didn't really ever come. I kind of just, basically after I signed those papers, I was on my own until like now, which just starting to talk to them again. But yeah, I mean, once I became a Marine, that was a new life.
What was boot camp like?
Well, you showed up and they have these yellow footprints that everyone stands on, and that's kind of symbolically showing that that's going to be the transition from you becoming a civilian and then to you becoming a United States Marine 3 months later. And everything was hard. Discipline was heavy. Just everything was different. You learned that you didn't actually need much to live. Daily things that you would take for granted are luxury. And everything was hard. That's what I expected. And that's why I joined.
So you never wanted to quit?
No, I mean, it sucked. It was miserable, but it was everything, you had to earn everything. Like, there's a saying in the Marine Corps, earn, never given. And for that was true. Like, you had to pay your dues in sweat and pain. And when we had classes, you paid attention. If you fell asleep, they introduced pain, made sure that you paid attention, and you'd never not pay attention again.
So what did you do in the Marines?
I was a infantry machine gunner. That job entails basically operating three different weapon systems: the M240 medium machine gun, the M250 cal heavy machine gun, and then the Mark 19 heavy machine gun. And the Mark 19 shoots 40-millimeter grenades instead of regular non-explosive rounds. But and the whole point of that job was to support the riflemen advancing onto an objective, or just we were heavy support for the maneuver element moving on to the enemy.
So what was it like the first time you got deployed? And when was that?
I first deployed in, I think, June of 2006. And we were already told that we weren't really going to do anything because we deployed to Okinawa. And it was really just we just trained for 6 months and we sailed around the Pacific. And then my second deployment was kind of, we were hoping we'd go to Iraq, but no, we never went, because we were just standby in case something kicked off in Iraq. But we sailed from California to Kuwait and trained in Kuwait, and we were just a reactive force in case that they needed an infantry battalion in Iraq. And 2009, this is May, I deployed, and that one was to Helmand Province, Afghanistan. And that was the first, I consider my first real deployment. Those other deployments I kind of considered just kind of training. But that one, I was kind of nervous because I hadn't been to combat yet, and our task was to take a Taliban-controlled area away from them. We were going to drop in a battalion into a district and pacify the enemy and then conduct stability operations afterwards.
So what was it like once you were over there doing missions?
Well, we all had a lot of levels of uncertainty. Like, we didn't know what we were going to get into. We prepared for everything. So if we could fit more ammo here, we could fit more food here, fit more water here. We jammed in as many things as we could. I would take the foam out of the Mark 19 ammo cans and then link them together. And I'd top load them to about, I think, 63 when they normally carry 48. So just everything we do, we thought we were going to get into the fight of our lives, and well, we did. And we prepared for everything we could, and we just assumed the worst thing would possibly happen.
So what was that like, getting in a firefight situation?
Well, the first engagement, I couldn't actually tell that I was getting shot at, because they say you'll see muzzle flashes, you hear gunshots, or you hear gun, you know, in movies. But you really hear the supersonic crack of rounds that next to your head, and that's the actual the rounds actually breaking the sound barrier. And that didn't really click that I was getting engaged. And what really did click is when they started dropping mortars on top of us, which they were about 50, 100 meters away. They were impacting right in front of our Humvee. And then we couldn't see the enemy. And it was kind of a scary feeling where you're getting, they're lighting you up, but you have no idea where they're at. And you're afraid to kind of engage because you don't know if there's any civilian populations around. But we ended up moving. Our standard procedure when we received indirect fire was to displace us to a different location so that the enemy mortar teams had a hard time bracketing us. So we moved to a village, and one of the gunners saw the insurgents actually moving through the a graveyard. So he engaged with a 50 cal. I didn't really know what was going on, and then I just kind of, I saw where his impacts were, and I matched it with the Mark 19, and I think there was two guys. I ended up, I didn't see it, but the other gunner said that my rounds impacted everywhere, and the guys kind of disappeared, because those rounds have a casualty raise of 15 meters, so basically if I hit anywhere near them, they're toast. But we moved later in the day. They ended up shooting a rocket at us from about, I think, a kilometer away. And that impacted right next to one of our Humvees. So we got online, and we were engaging about 1,300 meters away. And there were two guys out in the open that were shooting, and I had to use binoculars to see them. But I my driver ended up walking me on, and I think I let go a 20-round burst, and it covered the whole area, and smoke cleared, and those guys weren't there anymore, and there was really nowhere to hide. So, I mean, pretty sure they were toast. And that gunfight ended with us shooting a TOW anti-tank missile at them, and I think Cobra gunships coming in to cover our withdrawal. So that was my first engagement, 8-hour firefight.
What was it like going back to the base after that?
Well, we were all excited. We all were proud of ourselves. We all earned our combat action ribbons, or we call it CAR, which every infantryman, it's almost like a rite of passage. You can't be an infantryman and not have a CAR. It's like the football player that trains is never on varsity, like, and never gets to play a game. That's how we were. We were training, and at that time, we never got to play the game. This is like, we played the game, we were tested, and it was really, we were all afraid that we weren't up to it. Like, we were afraid that we would fail, and that it was a huge relief, because I knew that I had it in me to do what I trained to do. Because you can train someone like thousands of hours, but if that person doesn't have it in them, like, they'll break down in the worst possible moment, and you can't actually see it until you do it. There's no way to replicate combat.
So what was the camaraderie like with your unit?
Everyone in our, I was in truck 9, so everyone in my truck were really good friends. We all stayed in the same cramped Humvee together. We knew everyone's life stories the first night. Like, you live with these guys, and you wake up, and they're literally an arm reach away. Like, that's how close you live with these guys. And there was, like, the other two deployments I was on. I didn't know any of the guys once we got in country, because machine gun section leader. Then before that, I was machine gun squad leader. So they had me later run a squad of riflemen, and I didn't know any of them. And I think within that first week, like, I knew everyone's name. I knew where they came from. I knew everything about them. Like, you spend the whole time together. Like, there's no separation between you and your unit, your guys.
Since you've been back, do you still talk to members of your unit?
I still talk to guys I was there with. I mean, they're on Facebook, and I try to keep in contact with them. But yeah, it is hard because at the time, you got guys that are married, and they're closer to us than they're closer to some stranger they barely met than their wives and families are, just because that's all that matters that time and space. But I mean, you get back, and then I mean, everyone has to do their own thing, and you try to keep in touch, but at the same time, everyone goes to different places, so it's hard to keep in touch.
Did you have any friends not come back?
We had they weren't. I knew them, and I definitely had some drinks with them. There was Lance Corporal Baker, and this is in 1st Battalion, 5th Marine, so I was in Cat 2, and he was in 81s, and I've had a couple of drinks with him before. I didn't know him terribly well, but, like, he was a good guy, and, like, he was one of us in weapons company. And, he stepped on an IED, and he didn't come back. Then there was Johnson. I can't remember his name because he's one of the, like, I didn't know him that well because I showed up last minute. But again, I've smoked a couple cigarettes with him. I've seen him, you know, I've talked to him. You just know everybody, like, in the company. There'll be 150 guys in the company, and you'll know who everyone is and how they're like. And again, he got hit by an IED. There's a lot of acquaintances that, like, I ran into a guy when I was going to the bathroom, and we talked about cars for a bit. It's kind of bad. I don't think I remember his name, but I still remember his face. And, like, we talked to him for a while, and then I was like, all right, cool, you know, I'm going to go back to my area. And, you know, he did his thing, and I think a week or two later, there was an IED strike in the battalion, and then, they're like, oh, yeah, you know, one of the guys, he died. And it was my vehicle commander that actually walked by the memorial service, and he's like, hey, remember that guy that you went to the bathroom with? Like, yeah. It's like, yeah, that was him. Like, he's the one that got it. And then there's been quite a bit, but it's just, I've been lucky that, like, my really, really close friends didn't die, but it's not, like, it still hurts me that, like, these guys, like, you know, so it's hard that, you know, you deploy with them and then you come home and they're not there anymore. But the one the one person that kind of breaks me up is Timothy Donnelly. He didn't die, but I was never there to personally witness someone get hurt, and he was the first one and only one that I've witnessed. And he got both his legs blown off in front of me, and then we had to get him onto a helicopter and then evac him out. But it's kind of, a lot of guys don't write about what happens to a man when he loses both his legs and he's still alive. So it still gets me, like, to this day. So,
have you been in contact with him at all?
Yeah, I talk to him. I try to call him at least every month. Like, he's doing well now, but I mean, he's had, obviously had a way harder time than I have. But it's still, like, I was his squad leader, so, like, that was my responsibility, and It's really hard, especially because, at that time I was 26, and then he's only, 19 or 20. That was his first deployment, first operation, and then he got hurt, right away, right off the bat. So, it just sucks seeing, young guys that basically just want to help, and then they get hurt, and, they suffer for it.
So does the unit in your morale, does your morale go down in your unit is what I'm trying to say, or something like that?
Yeah, the unit really goes down, but, that's what part of being a Marine is. You gotta look at past battles, you got, ridiculous casualty rates, and, the mission's still there. You still have to complete the mission. And after he got hurt, I was pretty upset for that whole day, and they didn't have me do any running patrols. And, we still had to get on the bird and get out of there. And then we still had a deployment. We still had a war to fight. And it's kind of like you just don't have time to mourn yet, because you're not done. And I mean you could be the one that eats it next. So you just have to keep going.
So what was a daily operation, daily routine that you guys had?
On the 2009 deployment, that was to Nawa District. We were mobile, so we were mounted up on armored vehicles like Humvees and MRAPs, and we would just do patrols. Really just looking for bad guys. And then, but the 2010 deployment was the same thing. We'd just do patrols. We'd run to IEDs. We would interrogate them, confirm their IDs, call EOD. They'd dispose of them. And then sometimes we were tasked to go, initiate contact with the enemy, walk into his backyard and see what he does. And then, we'd exchange rounds. And then, but the 2012 deployment, we didn't really have an area to do patrols out of. So we did disruptive operations, and we were helo-borne. So those ones were kind of iffy because, we didn't know what we were getting into. It was kind of like Starship Troopers, where you kind of, you'll get dropped to a foreign area, and then you do the missions were always just patrol until and initiate contact with the enemy, and then basically try to neutralize as many enemy targets as you can. And then after a couple of days, before they can figure out where we're at, we exfil and then come back to our home base. Each time I was over there is completely different. Yeah, there's no pattern to it. Just whatever, we would do something, and the Taliban would do another thing, and then it was a constant game of who was getting better.
What was it like fighting an enemy that I'm told that it's, they don't stick out, that's hard?
It's very frustrating. Any counterinsurgency is going to be frustrating to fight. Basically, their greatest weapon is, the not being seen, and later you can kind of tell who the guys are. The normal people are going to try to get away from it. Obviously, when they heard our helicopters come in, they would just pick all their belongings up and leave. Anyone who stayed were most likely bad guys. It was definitely frustrating, but that's what you kind of had to keep on your toes. You couldn't stay the same because they would constantly change, so... The enemy was always trying something new and different, and we were always trying something new and different. And definitely it was frustrating not knowing, having a clear line of who the enemy was. And, most engagements we never saw the enemy. Most of the confirms kills we had were from snipers or indirect fire, which we'd actually have a powered optic that actually can see the Taliban and then engaging us, and then we would... that we'd either take a precision shot or we drop ordnance on top of them. But I mean, that's kind of the rules of the game. You just kind of, I mean, it's frustrating, but like if you got frustrated by it and it affected the way you fight, I mean, you could be the guy that ends up in the dirt. So you had to kind of just keep rolling with it.
How did the landscape of Afghanistan affect the kind of fighting?
The landscape was very open. So there were two zones, there's green zones and there's brown zones, at least in Helmand province. I mean, the rest of the country had mountains, but Helmand province was relatively flat and fertile. And that's where they grew most of the opium. So if you were in the green zone, the brush was really thick and you could possibly get in really close engagements, but it depended on what kind of year it is, but majority of the time it was very wide open terrain. So most of our engagements were from like anywhere from 300 meters away to like 1200 meters away. So like it was just very open terrain. And at the same time, villages were pretty cramped. So there have been pretty close engagements there just because they'd be hiding inside the village. But most of the fighting was done in big open expanse because the Taliban were pretty smart. Like, they didn't want to stay and fight because they knew that we would stay and fight. We'd call in our indirect fire assets. We'd call in air. And then they would want to leave so they can fight us a different day. So they like to be able to get away. So they start far, engage us, and then they withdraw before we get a chance to close with them. Or they would engage us from afar, knowing that we would close in on them, and then they would set up IEDs to get to basically maim our guys.
So what was your downtime like?
I tried to keep in shape as much as I could because obviously, like, I felt like my kind of my future depended on it. So I tried working as much as I could. I read a lot of books. We had, you know, listen to music on iPods, watch movies on laptops. But we even trained actually quite a bit. Just, I mean, even though you're in country, it doesn't mean that your skills aren't deteriorating. So we'd still work on basic combat skills, land navigation, magazine changes, weapons manipulations, like everything. So, but yeah.
Did you have some communication with friends, family back
home?
Oh
yeah, there. On the 2009 deployment, we really didn't. We had a satellite phone, but most of the time it didn't work. The 2010 deployment, I guess we had more access to, like internet or sat phones, and then the last deployment was on. We actually had pretty nice. They call them MWRs, morale, welfare, recreation centers, and they have, it's like a tent with a bunch of computers and telephones. So we got to go on Facebook and keep in touch pretty well in the last deployment.
So what was one thing, or multiple things that you, like really missed, from home that, or?
Well, I mean, just like creature comforts, like food really. Cause I mean, the food we ate was garbage and just, food, magazines from home, like up to date, things, just the news, new movies that come out, but I mean, I kind of like made do with a lot of stuff, and I actually enjoyed my time over there. So, I mean, other guys, they'd have letters from home, and obviously their friends and family and stuff they'd miss, and it was a really big morale booster. But I kind of just put my thoughts in books and movies.
You didn't keep a diary?
Oh, no, I recorded all this in a journal. So, yeah, anytime there'd be something significant happen, I'd write it down with dates and what I was thinking at the time. And I actually kept track from 2009 all the way to 2012. So three Afghan deployments I have written in my own words at my house.
Have you kept that up at all coming back?
Well, no, because I just didn't feel like, I mean, that was really just like a record of what I did there. I just didn't, you know, when I came back here, it's kind of like it was over, like the excitement was over. So I didn't really feel a need to continue writing into it. And plus, I mean, it's got, the journal itself is like sunburn, there's sand, sweat, dirt all over it. It's like, I mean, it was there, like it physically was there with me. So I don't want to touch it too much and deteriorate it.
So do you ever go back and read any?
I haven't done so in a while. But I know, like, or I don't even actually look at old pictures either, just because if I do, I usually will end up spend hours just looking through everything and just kind of, there's like memories you don't want to forget, but I mean, time has its way with things. Yes, if I look at them, I'll probably look at them for like several hours. So I guess I don't have really too much time to do that while I'm going to classes.
Do you have any awards or artifacts?
Or artifacts?
Yeah.
Basically, I was, besides the regular awards that you get for just being there, I guess I got two NAMs with Vs, Navy Achievement Medals with a V for Valor Device. And I got the first one just because basically any squad leader that led a patrol through a gunfight got it. It's kind of a pat in the back, like, hey, you could lead guys in combat. I mean, you're responsible for all this. And then the second NAM I wasn't really too proud of because basically when Timothy Donnelly got hit, I guess it was just they were proud of the actions I did to save him, even though that I felt that, if I did a good job, he wouldn't have gotten hurt in the first place. So it's just, you can't really control everything, but I still don't feel right receiving an award for someone getting hurt and me just doing my job to save him.
What was your impression of what the Afghanistan citizens thought of you guys?
They were kind of hit or miss because like some people truly didn't like the Taliban, but unfortunately most of the population supported the Taliban just because we were the foreign infidels. And then the Taliban were actually other Muslims that they could relate to. There were times when the whole deployment, they were nice to us, and at the end of the deployment, we found out that the Taliban were just paying the local citizens to be nice to us so that, you know, they could actually gather intelligence on us. It was hard watching them because, I mean, we knew they were stuck in the middle. If they supported us, the Taliban would come in at night and terrorize them, torture, maim, kill, intimidate. And then, if they supported the Taliban, then they wouldn't get any of our services, and basically we would view them as supporting the enemy, and they could possibly get stuck in a gunfight between us, and, you know, we end up dropping bombs on them, or just, it's kind of either way, they couldn't win. Either they sided with us and got, torture, maim, kill for it, or they sided with the Taliban, and the big might of the coalition would come down on them. So, most of the Afghan people were just trying to get by. Like, they don't really have a sense of a country. For example, like Kabul is just like the Karzai, the president of Afghanistan. He's really just the mayor of Kabul, because nobody in Helmand liked him or even knew who he was, and Like, they more related to Pakistanis than they did with other Afghans, just because they don't really have a sense of, like, a country. They're there. That's their land. They've been living off their land for millenniums, and that's how they do things. And, for example, I've been told the only way you can tell what time it is in Afghanistan is the color of the uniform of the foreign invading army. So, I mean, that's just how that's how life is for them, and they've been doing that ever since.
So did your unit serve with foreign units as well?
Yes. I mean, we were partnered with the Afghan National Army, Afghan National Police, and then they also had these the Tiger units, in which they would have these the Afghan National Army's special operations units, and basically they were led by either a Royal Marine Commando or a British paratrooper. And so, I mean, we obviously spoke the same language, and they would use different weapons, but we were all in the same fight. And then we had and then we worked with the Brits a lot, and there were other units that were there, like Georgians. I know the units before us worked with before we showed up, 2-7, they had to work with the British, Estonians. They had, let's see, I think they had Georgians too, yeah. But yeah, they had to work with a lot of different units that's why they're not, it's not all American forces or British forces and the coalition forces, because we've had French Mirages do flybys for us. A lot of different countries. I mean, it's all of NATO was involved in the conflict, and we all support each other. And then British helicopters that would run our medevac sometimes.
So what was it like when you got home from Afghanistan?
Every time we came back, it was definitely, we knew, you know, it was a big relief. We were out of the country. You didn't have to constantly worry that someone's trying to kill you. But then you have to, at the same time, you've been behind for 7 months. But the rest of the world has moved and you have not. You've done the same thing for 7 months. And it's kind of difficult readjusting. And then eventually, you know, you readjust, you get used to it. There's guys here and there that suffer from PTSD, and they become alcoholics, and then they kind of end up destroying their lives from it. But most of the guys keep their head on straight, and then, I mean, we got more deployments to come. So, you know, you get back in the saddle, you get back in the training, because we're doing it again. And why are we doing it again? Yeah, because we're Marines, and we have to do it. And but, yeah, once it was all over, then in especially transitioning out of the Marine Corps, it's definitely really difficult, and I'm still having issues here and there. But I mean, I did for 8 years, so it was every 8 years of my adult life, which is my whole adult life, I was wearing a uniform, carrying a weapon, and now it's just certain things that your body was used to that kept you alive, defense mechanisms. And then now it's kind of, you know, it's time to break those down, and I'm not in a war zone anymore. This is Missoula, Montana. So and every person transitions different. Some people had it harder than others, and it's just hard to go from what you were so used to. Like, I call it being on autopilot. You just do things, and you don't know how it got done, but you somehow did it, and that's just how everything runs. And now you have to change the programming. You can't just be on autopilot, because everything's different now. So, but yeah, definitely people transition differently, and definitely what helps is being in contact with other people that had the same experiences, and then you share it with other veterans.
In my mouth. Okay, so as a leader, did you ever reach out to guys that you saw struggling as they came back?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of guys that had a lot of issues, and a lot of guys actually came and asked for advice just because by that time I was the old guy. I was 26. Most of these guys were like 22s or 23, and some people were thinking about reenlisting and continuing a career in the Marine Corps. Some people wanted to get out, and then just from I've seen a lot of what happened, I've seen several cycles of people coming into the Marine Corps and leaving the Marine Corps. And, there's guys that had a lot of issues and that we had to help out. And unfortunately, sometimes it was too late to help them. They already did a lot of damage, and they ended up getting in trouble with the law or with substance abuse. But, as a leader, especially in the Marine Corps, as a leader, you're supposed to watch for that, because you're not really someone that just leads them. You run them. Like, you're responsible for every one of them. What they do is your fault. So you try to watch out for as much many guys, but some people don't talk, and some people just, you can't really predict what they do.
So why did you decide to come to the University of Montana?
one of my seniors actually from 1st Battalion, 5th Marines, went to school here, and he lives here, and I kept in contact with him, and it's funny because I hadn't talked to him in 3 years, but when I showed up in my truck, it was just, hey, what's going on? It was instantly, I knew him already. Like, I knew him, and even with, like, let's say your loved ones or, like, your family members, you have to, catch up, or this and that happened. But, I mean, with guys you kind of cut your teeth with, that you don't need to do that. It's just you're back. Like, they subconsciously, you both understand each other at that level, and you don't have to really explain anything. It's just understood. So, I mean, that's the biggest reason. It's because I couldn't imagine coming here by myself and doing everything. It's just be kind of overwhelming. And now he liked it here, and I kind of wanted a fresh start and wanted to go somewhere I'd never been. And then Montana just seemed like a awesome place to go to start a new chapter in my life, just to begin my non-military adult life.
So what are you majoring in?
I'm going in for accounting, and then hopefully I can minor in Russian too. And then with that, I try to tack on my international business. But right now, just accounting is the big one, but I mean, subject to change. I'm only a freshman, so.
So, what's been the hardest thing being a freshman this year? Hard to adjust.
Well, obviously, classes. Obviously, I'm kind of the older guy in the class, and kind of the freshmen do this and that, or just kind of that everything runs at a slower pace. And for example, in the military, like if you received a classes. Like, everything was ownership. So if you didn't know the content, it was your instructor's fault. And here it's kind of like you have to know it, and it's not anyone. It's your own fault if you don't know it. So it's kind of there's no one really kind of guiding everyone to make sure everyone knows it and that everyone's on the same page. So you kind of have to just strive and do things for yourself. That's what I found the most difficult.
What do you like to do for fun?
I like going hiking. I go to the rec center often, like exercising, going running. And I try to stay outdoors as much as I can, just stay active.
What's been the hardest part now that you're out of the Marines, just getting back into everyday life?
The hardest part would just really be, just adjusting, because I've heard it takes a while, like months to years, to fully adjust, because there's obviously just mechanisms in your body and in your mind that you can't shut off, and just they go away throughout time. And, for example, I have really bad short-term memory now, and it's just trying to get back into it, or just being able to, you have to like cognitively do activities now. Whereas, you know, in the military, you need to know what it is, but you can actually get away with just running things completely tired. But now you can't do that if you actually have to like use your head to complete assignments or do tests. Or so it's a completely different kind of difficulty. And you could always endure in the Marine Corps. You always endure the physical pain. You always tell yourself, keep going. It's mental toughness, but yeah, you know, while you're doing that mental toughness, you're not actually trying to figure something out. So now it's completely shifted to just using your head more.
Have you ever had flashbacks? Or?
Yeah, I actually get those pretty often. Just every so often, things will remind me of certain things, or just not quite, you know, flashbacks, but I'll just think about it the whole day. Or sometimes, there's none of it is in a bad way. Some of these mountains in Montana kind of look like some of the scenery I was in Afghanistan. So, when I first started school, I had issues where everything around me would start turning sand color, and then I look down, I'm still in uniform, or just afraid that like I'm gonna wake up and I'm actually like this was all a dream, that you're actually still over there in Afghanistan. It's just I guess a place like Afghanistan doesn't really leave you like ever. It just it'll always be with you in the back of your head.
So what do you do to manage something like that?
I currently go to therapy. I recently started going to church. I talked to my friend about it and kind of relate. And I talked to other veterans about these issues and relate with them. But really the best is just like time. Because eventually, I mean, not what I was when I first started school compared to what I was now is night and day. Like every week, every day I change. I'm slowly unraveling all the things that I had in the Marine Corps.
So overall, what was your impression on the U.S.'s success in the war in Afghanistan?
Basically, I thought that no country ever has successfully conquered Afghanistan, and that's a lot of multiple reasons for that. One, because the country there eventually will just figure out that it's not worth it. I believe that we should have just fought Al-Qaeda and gotten justice for September 11th. And I personally feel that the Afghan people do not deserve what we did for them, and they don't really care what we're doing for them. They're really just there to leech as much money as they can, kind of like... You can always rent an Afghan. You can never buy one. So they'll always just be there to be nice, but it's just collecting your money. And I think we just – not like we didn't waste our efforts over there. It's just that we should have gone about it a different way because, in my opinion, the Afghan people aren't worth what we gave them. And kind of like a – like a common joke, it's like, well, if your economy and your country sucks, let me just say that you have nuclear weapons and the United States will bomb your country and rebuild it for you. But, no, I don't think I have anywhere to say, just because anything to say pertinent to the whole decade-long war, because, I mean, the guys upstairs have decided, and that's what was told of us, and our job was to do what they told us to do, is to support the United States foreign policy on things, and we did our job, and that's all that matters. And when you were on the ground, you never thought, you never were like, oh, hey, this is wrong and we should do this, or it's no, this is their job and I don't really care, just as long as all you guys come back with me, and that's all that matters, because that is all that matters. Is who, honestly, we really didn't care, like, those people, they... It sucks, but I don't want their issues messing with us, and kind of like a kill or be killed kind of situation. But no, we did our job. We fought, we came back as many people as we could, we saved as many people as we could, and we did what they told us to. And I think that's all that I rate to say about it, because I don't think I don't feel like I have any place in saying why we were there or anything. It's just we were told to. It's as simple as that.
Looking back, would you join up again?
Yeah, actually, I try to change it so I could actually go over there more often. I guess I was one of those war junkies. I wanted to just keep going back. I wanted to be the guy that just kept going back, and that's the whole reason I wanted to do it. I didn't want to. It wasn't because of the uniform. It was because the chance to fight, and it was exciting. And I would do it differently in that I would try to go back more. And if this war was still happening, I would have never gotten out. If this war lasted forever, I would have been in the Marine Corps for forever. But I don't feel that I have a place in the Marine Corps when there's no war happening anymore. So,
what was it like when you put the uniform on for the first time?
Oh, I felt, you put it on, you look yourself in the mirror, and it has a really big psychological impact. Like, everyone looks the same, but that's not a bad thing. That means that everyone's on the same side, everyone's on the same team. And there's definitely a sense of pride in wearing it, because you know you're wearing it, you're part of less than 1% of America that's wearing it. And it's definitely, it's symbolic that you're fighting for America.
What was their sense from friends and family and even bystanders when you came back? Was it support or what was that like?
I mean, I never advertised it, but I mean, if it ever came out, for the most of the time, they'd support you. If you're near like a military base, they didn't really care. But I mean, I was never one to advertise it, just because I'd rather not have attention brought up upon me. But definitely, if it ever came up in a conversation, then yeah, most Americans would actually show their support or give me thanks. And I do appreciate it. It's just really awkward, just because like most of us don't do it for that. We just know that that's it. You know, that's what it is. We don't need people to say thanks to us. It's just, I mean, we didn't. That's not why we did it. You know, for anything that other people give us.
So, so back at the University of Montana here, what has helped you in readjusting?
Really, just being around other veterans and then just kind of seeing what they did and how they coped with their issues. Realizing that my job now is just to focus on studying. Definitely going to the rec center and working out, like, that definitely helps out quite a bit. But the number one thing would be just to connect with other veterans and kind of share stories, kind of see what they did, and they'll see what you did. And because those thoughts and stories will still stick with you, and it's kind of a relief to be able to tell the people and have them understand.
I think with that, thank you, Tony, very much. Keith McLaughlin and Tony Lynn here, signing out.